Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It's been a good news, bad news kind of week. The Houston Chronicle uncovered how tens of thousands of Texas kids with disabilities have been illegally kept out of the state's special education system. I'll speak with the reporter who broke the story. Later on in the episode, a new report from the Avid Prison Project finds a national epidemic of people with mental illness being warehoused in solitary confinement. I'm joined by the report's author to dig into her findings and what we can do to reverse this horrifying trend. But first, the good news. Every September, the Census Bureau releases annual data on income, poverty, and health insurance, giving us a snapshot of how the nation is faring in all three of those areas. And this year, we had a lot to celebrate. With me to unpack the data, what they showed, and what they mean for the road ahead is Bob Greenstein. He's the founder and president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. Happy Poverty Data Week, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. So I know you're slammed crunching numbers and looking at tables. Give us a rundown. You used the word historic to describe what the data showed. Why were they historic?
So I've been looking at this annual census report, which covers poverty, income, health insurance coverage, back since the 1980s. This is the single best single-year report I've ever seen. Why is that? Well, first, it showed that the number of Americans who were uninsured fell 4 million between 2014 and 2015, on top of a 9 million drop the year before, with the result that the share of Americans who were uninsured fell to 9%, and the share of children who were uninsured fell to 5%. Now, that's still too high. I think we'd all agree. But this is really historic progress. This is the smallest percentage of Americans being uninsured in the nation's history. On the income side, it showed that the typical household's income, this is the family right in the middle of the income scale, rose by 5.2% or $2,800 after adjusting for inflation, even more than that if you didn't adjust for inflation, but of course one should. That's the biggest increase in median income in a single year, with data back to 1967, and it gets us almost all the way back to where median income was in 2007, before the Great Recession hit. By the way, Rebecca, you know, the immediate news coverage of this said really good news, but rural America was left out. Their poverty rate didn't go down. Their median income didn't go up much. It turns out that that was a mistake, and that rural America actually benefited in 2015 as much as urban America did. The reason the original figures looked discouraging there when they came out on Tuesday of this week was that the Census Bureau changed this year the definition of which counties and areas are metro and which are rural, and that skewed the comparison. Yesterday, Thursday, Census released a lot more data that adjusts for that, and it turns out that on an apples-to-apples basis, the increase in median income and decrease in poverty was as large in rural America in 2015 as in urban America. And talking about poverty, the poverty rate fell from 14.8% in 2014 to 13.5% in 2015. That's the single largest improvement in a year since 1968, although we should note it's still a full percentage point higher than poverty was in 2007 before the Great Recession hit. So, you know, we have considerable further progress to make. We still have an unusually high level of poverty relative to Western Europe, even though we're the world's richest economy. But this is really very good progress for 2015. Our task now is to keep it going.
Now, you've described historic, and I think from your description, the word historic seems to be totally spot on, but you've described serious progress on poverty, on median household income, and on health insurance. Is it normal to see that kind of progress, or any progress, on all three of those measures in the same year?
No, this is the first time since 1999 that all three measures improved in the same year. And 1999, if I recall, was when we had the hottest economy in decades and the unemployment rate was falling toward 4%. There were a few other years of economic recovery since 2000 when poverty went down and median income went up. But in those years, health insurance coverage didn't improve. In fact, typically in those years, the share of the population that was uninsured got worse. We often have short memories. We tend to forget that before passage of the Affordable Care Act, whether the economy was good or whether the economy was bad, either way, the percentage and number of Americans who were uninsured rose almost every year as employer coverage kept eroding and there was nothing in its place. The dramatic turnaround in health insurance, without question, is due to the Affordable Care Act and its coverage expansions.
So we're partying like it's 1999, it sounds like, and it's fun to actually pop the corks for once, because I think you and we at CAP and others have become very accustomed to sort of stagnant incomes and minimal progress on poverty. So a lot of fun to finally have something to celebrate. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act, but what is behind the gains that we're seeing in poverty and income?
So there are two factors behind the gains in poverty and income. One, of course, is the economy. It's finally growing more strongly. 2015 provides vivid evidence of a really important point, both for poverty and for the economy, and that is simply that when we get at or very close to full employment, not only do more Americans have jobs, but wages rise, particularly on the lower rungs of the income ladder. When there are lots of people looking for work, employers are not under pressure to pay good wages because there are so many applicants. When the labor market tightens, employers have to start pushing up wages to attract workers. It happened in the late 1990s when real wages, wages after adjusting for inflation, rose across the income scale, including at the bottom, and it happened in 2015. In fact, in 2015, average income rose faster at the bottom of the income scale than at the top of the income scale. But it wasn't just due to the economy. It was also due to government policy. In addition to the Affordable Care Act's effect on health insurance, we had a number of states and some localities raised the minimum wage in 2014 so that it took effect in 2015 or during 2015. And those wage increases also played an important role here in the improvement in income and the reduction in poverty, particularly in terms of income for people in lower wage jobs.
Now, there have been some conservatives out there saying, let's not get too excited. These data are just a blip. We're going to see things go back to what we had gotten used to as the new normal next year. Do you think that they're right to be dampening everyone's expectations?
No. So we have data on wages through and various economic factors through July or August, and it shows continued progress in 2016 on top of the progress in 2015, although not at as rapid a rate. We also have health insurance surveys that, for example, the Centers for Disease Control run, and we already have data from those surveys for the first quarter of 2016, and it shows further reductions in the numbers of uninsured in 2016. I do think the risk we face is that we haven't abolished the business cycle, meaning at some point, hopefully not for a number of years, but at some point, there will be another recession. And whenever another recession hits, we always go backwards in recession. But I think that underscores two things. Number one, keep the progress going now. The Federal Reserve should not raise interest rates, in my view. Inflation is still below its target. If it raises interest rates, that's going to slow all these processes. given the intransigence in Congress, hopefully more states and localities will raise their minimum wages. You at CAP and we at the Center on Budget are working for further improvements in refundable tax credits for low-income working families. All of these things could be important. We need to do them. And I'm looking a little down the road here, but in my view, we should already start to get ready for whenever it is that the next recession hits by starting to put mechanisms in place now, if we could get Congress to go along, that would automatically trigger improvements in various programs and policies when the economy goes down, whether it's 1 year from now or 5 years from now. We really should be making sure that we do everything we can to absolutely minimize and counter-effect the effects on poverty and income and health coverage of the next recession, whenever it is that it should come.
Now, of course, a recession could take us back into the wrong direction on all of these types of measures.
Yes.
But even absent a recession, are there particular policies or proposals that you've heard floated that you feel would risk erasing the gains that we've seen?
Absolutely. There are proposals, for example, as you know, to repeal the Affordable Care Act. If that happened, the 20 million or so people who have gained coverage, many or all of them could lose it. And then on top of that, of course, as both CAP and the Center on Budget have warned about, there are proposals from House Speaker Paul Ryan and others to essentially abolish programs like SNAP, food stamps, rental vouchers, and the like as we know it, and just turn them into one big block grant to states that could be a slush fund to fill holes in state budget and divert money from actually helping poor families move forward.
I've been speaking with Bob Greenstein. He's the founder and president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Bob, you and I will need to find time to go party like it's 1999.
But before that, as your last question indicated, we all have a lot of work to do, both to make sure we don't go backward and to make sure we continue to make progress forward, because, as I think most of your listeners would agree, this progress is excellent. But the levels of hardship, poverty, and uninsurance should still be unacceptable to all Americans.
Bob, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Last week, it came to light that Texas education officials had quietly and illegally been keeping tens of thousands of students with disabilities out of special education for more than a decade. The Houston Chronicle's investigative reporting quickly went viral and has spurred education officials in the state to do a quick 180, vowing to end the illegal policy. With me to discuss how he messed with Texas is the reporter who broke the story, the Chronicle's Brian Rosenthal. Brian, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So help our listeners understand what has been going on in Texas. What did your investigative reporting find?
We found that in 2004, the Texas Education Agency adopted a policy that had never been adopted by any other state. And it set a target percentage for what percentage of students should be receiving special education services. And it said to school districts in the state that if they exceeded that target, they could face a range of penalties and would maybe be compelled to file corrective action plans to rectify the situation. And otherwise fix it.
So that benchmark, that limit that they put in place was 8.5%. But help us put that in context. What percentage of students in Texas have disabilities and should have access to special ed services?
So it's a little unclear about the exact number. There has been no research that has determined what percentage of students need special education. And the reason why is that it doesn't exactly line up with different disability categories that you might think of. I mean, some of them surely do line up, but there are some other categories that are included in special education, specifically learning disabilities, which is when you have dyslexia is the most common example. It's when you're completely fine on everything, and you are very good at each subject area except for reading. That's basically what dyslexia is. But you could also have a learning disability in other categories. You could have a learning disability in math, where you're perfectly fine in everything except for math. So that's a learning disability, and those are not really counted by the types of public health statisticians that do this type of work. So there isn't that's a long way to say there isn't an exact number for how many, what percentage of students should be in special education. What we can go by, what I think a lot of experts go by, is what the national average is, because that's an average of, you know, 50 different states, what they end up doing. And the national average is about 13%, or actually a little higher, of students receive special education services. So the 8.5 obviously is very much below that, and state officials have actually acknowledged that there was no research basis for that, that there was no evidence that is an ideal number.
So as your reporting makes clear, this decision was nakedly about money. The state wanted to shrink spending on special education, so they came up with an arbitrary cap, and they were very successful. They did. They saved billions of dollars. So maybe just to ask a fairly simple question, but one that I think is important as sort of a threshold of understanding what the state did here, what's wrong with setting a limit like this?
Sure. So, and I do want to clarify something you said at the very top. You said this is clearly illegal, and that is something that is still under debate. Lots of people say that it's illegal, but the state obviously says it's not. We respect their opinion. What I can tell you is that the federal law says that schools must serve all children, all eligible children with any type of disability. And so a lot of people are interpreting the target, even if it is not a blanket prohibition on serving more kids than 8.5%. Because again, school districts, there are school districts in the state that still serve more than 8.5%, and they've been penalized for it through this accountability system, but they do exist. But people say that even the idea of setting a target, no matter how much teeth is behind it, is contrary to the federal law, which says that you have to serve everybody.
Now, to be clear, though, there is federal law on the books in the form of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, that makes very clear that all students are entitled by law to a free and appropriate public education, and that includes special education services if they qualify.
Exactly. Yeah, that is the law that a lot of people think this violates. Basically, the state's argument, and I guess I alluded to it earlier, but I can state it more clearly. The state's argument about why this policy is legal is that they say that this is not a cap at all. They say it's just a goal. They actually now have said that there's really no teeth behind it. They don't really punish school districts for going over 8.5%. And it's just a goal for schools to keep in mind. And so that's why they say it's legal. What we uncovered in our reporting, and what I think is really important, is we talked to more than 300 educators and parents and experts. And what we found is, regardless of what the state now says, this policy has been interpreted over the past decade as a cap. School districts have taken it very seriously. More than a dozen teachers and administrators admitted, embarrassed, that they had denied services to children to stay below this cap, and below this what they called a cap. And so we found a range of things that school districts have done to reduce their special ed enrollment. 96% of school districts in the state of Texas have reduced their special ed enrollments in the years since this policy went into effect. So that's the nuance there, though, is that the state officials are saying that it's not really a hard cap, it's more of a goal, but school districts have clearly interpreted it as a pretty strict mandate.
And in speaking with the Texas Education Agency for this investigative reporting, did they ever explain the motivation or the reasoning behind setting this cap? Did they have any way of explaining what they were doing aside from just seeking budget savings?
They did not explain it to us, no. What they have done is, since the article has been published, they've come under a lot of pressure. And I do have to clarify something else he said, which is that the Texas Education Agency itself has not vowed to end this policy. There are a lot of officials in the state who are saying they will work to end this policy, but the Texas Education Agency has said that it's going to conduct a review. It hasn't made a decision about what to do yet. It has, though, in response to the pressure that it's been receiving, it has offered a motivation, which is that it says that they had concerns over identification of students, that there were too many students receiving special ed, students without disabilities were receiving these services. So that may have been a motivation. That one is a little hard to understand based on our reporting, because at the time this policy was set, Texas was actually below the national average in terms of special ed. So the national average, as I said, 13% or a little higher. When this policy was set, Texas was at 12%, so still much higher than 8.5%, but below the national average. It's a little curious that they would be concerned about over-identification.
A little curious indeed. So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that for the more than a decade since 2004 that this benchmark, cap, whatever it is, has been in place, that schools have been taking steps to try to comply for the most part. What kinds of efforts have states across the state been putting forth to try to comply with this benchmark? What were you hearing from teachers when you were doing this reporting?
Yeah, so most of what we reported in the story was actually not just anecdotally from teachers. It was based on documents and internal emails that we found. And actually what was most helpful were the corrective action plans that school districts were required to fill out when they went over 8.5%. Many districts were required to fill out these corrective action plans, and they lay out specifically how the district planned to lower their enrollments. And they were pretty frank in these corrective action plans, even though some of what was in them was, we found, specifically prohibited by the federal government. Their tactics for lowering the rates, some of them were prohibited. But I think a really good example of the types of things we're talking about, and I've mentioned this in a couple other interviews, is Henderson ISD. Which is a relatively small district in East Texas near Tyler. It's not a huge district, but I think it's illustrative. What they did is the process, the way it worked before this state policy went into effect was in Henderson ISD, Henderson Independent School District, they had a policy in which if a teacher thought that a student might have a disability, he or she was struggling and seemed to be exhibiting signs of a disability, and the teacher thought that maybe the student should be tested to see if he or she qualified for special education, there was a form that they could submit and an evaluation would be done. And these forms were kind of given to teachers at the beginning of the year, and if they ever needed them, they could use them. So what Henderson did after this policy was put in place, and you know they have said that they did this in their official policy, they put in place a new practice in which they actually went to all the schools and they collected all the forms They took all the special ed evaluation request forms and they rounded them up, took them out of the schools, and put them in the central office where the teachers could access them, but only if they went to the central office, you got permission from their supervisor, and, you know, went through a couple of hurdles. And so basically what they're doing is they're making it harder for teachers to get those evaluations done and get students into special ed.
And that's just one of the tactics that your reporting uncovered. You also describe some parents actually being counseled to take their children out of public school.
Right. That one was not as detailed in black and white in corrective action plans. But we did talk to dozens of parents, and they over and over again said that what would happen is they would go to the school and say that their child was struggling and that they maybe he or she had been diagnosed with a disability by a private provider, and they thought that maybe they could try and get he or she evaluated for special ed. And the schools would say things like, man, that's going to require a lot of work. I think it, what would be best, we don't have the services to be able to do that, to be able to best serve your child. What would be best for him or her is if he or she went to a private school where they have more services, and here's a list of private schools that can serve your child better. Or some schools would say that's the type of thing that they really would benefit from being very close to their parents. You know your child best, and being able to serve the kid is going to be much more effective if you do it, and so you really should consider just homeschooling the kid. So yeah, we heard lots of stories of parents basically being counseled out of special ed, which of course is problematic because the federal law says that the schools have an obligation to serve these children.
So in uncovering what has really become sort of an education scandal, you said that you used documents that were actually on file and that were accessible. I have to ask this question because in my own reading of your reporting and thinking about the fact that this has been going on since 2004, I was struck just wondering, how has this not come to light until now, considering the scale of what was going on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when I first went to my editor to tell him about the story 6 months ago and asked for some time to look into it, I told him this is a shocking story, but in some ways the most surprising part about the story is that it's never been written before, because this is a policy that was communicated to all school districts in the state. It was not publicly announced. It was not the result of any sort of legislation. And so it was not in the public side, but all the school districts were told about it, obviously, and that's why they took all these steps to respond to it. And so it's a question that I am that I struggled with about why this had not come to light, especially because in my experience and in talking with these advocates and parents of children with disabilities, they are very passionate about finding out information about how best to serve these kids. So I think what happened was, first of all, very few people knew this existed even up until I contacted them. A couple advocacy groups had found out about it a little earlier in the year. But I think people assumed that this was a federal mandate because of the way that it was implemented without public discussion. And I think they assumed that it was something that was, you know, took place in every state and was backed up by research and was just something that was a reality and wasn't, I don't think they realized that it was a policy decision made by the Texas Education Agency just because of the way that it was rolled out. And I think that really contributed to people not speaking up about it. I think in talking with some former school teachers and administrators, I also heard that school districts were not that eager to complain about this because some of them, and of course, I don't want to say all of them. School people who work in schools are very dedicated, and they do a job that I could not do. But I think some of the administrators, from what I heard, were happy to cut back on special ed because it's a big cost to them. It's a big cost to the state, but it's also a big cost to school districts. And so this is something that benefited them in that way.
What got you interested in this story? How did this come onto your radar initially?
We were looking, quite frankly, to do a story this year investigating how children fare in the state of Texas. And in Texas, I cover state politics and state government, and the state legislature actually only meets once every 2 years down here. And so that provides an opportunity, really, in the off years when they're not meeting, to do investigative work, to look into some of these things. And so we were actively looking for a project about children in the state of Texas. And an advocate came to me, I happened to talk to him, and he presented me with basically a mystery, which was, why does Texas give special education services to a far, far lower percentage of its students than any state in the country? And this particular advocate actually did not know the answer. And I didn't know the answer. And so it was a real mystery that we were motivated to tackle. And of course, what we found out was much more surprising than we expected, to be honest.
Do you or do advocates in Texas expect that the Texas Education Agency or that any other relevant entities in the state are at risk of facing penalties or perhaps lawsuits as a result of what your reporting has exposed?
A lot of people believe that, yes. As we talked about earlier, there are a lot of people that think this violates federal law. I think advocates I've heard are talking about potentially filing a lawsuit. The federal government, U.S. Department of Education, has said in response to our story that they are looking into this issue, and they will determine if further actions are necessary. So there's the possibility of action from the federal government. That is a possibility. The interesting thing with this story that is different than any other story I've covered, to be honest, is that the stakes of this are so high, because if Texas provided special ed services at the same rate as the rest of the country, 250,000 more students would be receiving special ed, which is obviously a huge number and would obviously be great for those students. However, it would cost the state literally billions of dollars, something like $2 billion a year at least, to provide those services. And so the state is going to have to be very cautious in its response, and it has been very cautious in its response, because the stakes are very high for what could happen to it.
Now, you corrected me, and I appreciate that, because I want to get this right and I don't want to mislead in any way. But in the wake of your reporting, it's not the Texas Education Agency, but other education officials and stakeholders who have vowed, to use the word you use in your headline from earlier this week in a follow-up story, they've vowed to stop using these kinds of arbitrary limits on how many students can access special education. Do you expect that we're going to see a reversal? Are they, or are the people who need to be, serious about making a change? And what will you be looking for in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, I don't like predicting things. I'm not a predictor.
You're a reporter. That's fair.
But I think, as I said, I think people are reacting cautiously to this report, which they should. Given the gravity of it, I think people are grappling with it. And certainly there are lots of people who are outraged by it and who want to take action. And I think advocates are thinking about the best way to do that. I think the prediction I'll make is that there will be a discussion about this in the next legislative session, which starts in January. if the federal government does not intervene before then, which they've said is a possibility. And so there are different avenues how this could change. But as I mentioned, it's early in the process, and I think people are going to wait for it to play out a little bit, which I think is a good opportunity to mention that we are not done with this story. This is actually part one of our series, but we have other parts in the works, and so keep reading.
I'm speaking with Brian Rosenthal. He is a reporter with the Houston Chronicle and broke a story exposing Texas for keeping tens of thousands of students with disabilities, possibly more, out of special education. Brian, you spoke with parents I'm not sure if you spoke with students, but you spoke with families as well as teachers as part of this reporting. I wonder if you could help us put a face on some of the students and the families who have been harmed by this kind of policy, and no need to use names, but I wonder if you would be willing to share a story or two.
Well, sure. I mean, the story that I think we wrote about in our article, and I think we talked to a lot of families. I interviewed more than 80 families in person or over the phone, and we heard a lot of different stories about how kids have been affected. But the story that we featured in the article, I think, really does a good job of illustrating what we're talking about. So I'll tell that one if that's okay with you. And I can use the name, of course, because they are we use the name in the story. The child's name is Ronan Walker, who is a very sweet boy. He is now 7. He was diagnosed at age 4 with ADHD, generalized anxiety, and severe sensory deficits, which is similar to autism. It's when you have trouble coping with some things around you. For him, he has trouble in crowds, he has trouble socializing, and is pretty much fine on his own, but has meltdowns often around other people and gets overwhelmed. Obviously, school is something that has a lot of people in it, and so he struggled there. When he went to kindergarten, he had meltdowns often. He struggled in the classroom, and his parents tried to get him evaluated for special ed repeatedly, and the school district kept putting off the parents. They told the parents that they could fix this kid with better medication. They put him into a cheaper alternative program, which is common here in Texas, called Section 504. They said that his IQ was too high. And they kept putting the parents off. And Ronan suffered as a result of this. He was, he went into school as really a smart and promising kid. And in kindergarten, he had to be restrained multiple times. He had meltdowns often. His academic performance slipped. In kindergarten, he was in the 67th percentile in letter knowledge. By first grade, he was in the 16th percentile. He, in first grade, started getting suspended. He started having a lot of behavior issues. He was suspended 11 times in the first half of first grade. And this is a six-year-old, and, you know, it's controversial even to suspend a six-year-old, any six-year-old, but someone with a diagnosed disability 11 times. It was very traumatic for him. He became depressed, and eventually his parents overheard him saying some suicidal thoughts. He said he was a bad kid, he didn't deserve to live, he wasn't, you know, didn't fit in, things of that nature.
And this is a 7-year-old child.
Yeah, he was 6 when this started, these statements started. He was scratching himself, and so eventually his parents pulled him out of school, and they now homeschool him, and they have taken it upon themselves to educate him on their own.
So Ronan's story is heartbreaking. I'm sure most of our listeners will feel the same way, right? It's one thing to think about the numbers that you found and uncovered and the patterns, but to really actually think about the human beings that are being harmed by this kind of a policy really takes it to a whole other level. Part of Ronan's story that you just mentioned, I want to hone in on for the last couple of minutes that I have with you, which is that he was suspended from school and also restrained in school. Now, not part of your reporting, but another study out of Texas in the last couple of years found that nearly 75% of Texas students with disabilities were suspended or expelled between a 10-year period. 75%. Now, I should say, to put this in context, that same study, which looked at 1 million adolescent students in the state of Texas, found that nearly 60% of students overall were suspended or expelled. And I'm looking at the study looked at 7th to 12th graders. So it's 75% is incredibly high, but of course 15% higher than the state average. But do you see a relationship between failure to educate properly and in-school suspension or even expulsion as one of the consequences of this policy?
Yes, we do see that. We heard over and over again about children who, you can see a clear line between children who have a disability and need help to be successful in school. When they don't get that help, they become frustrated and they start to resent school and they have bad behaviors as a result of that. And in addition, we also heard about, and there actually was some coverage of this last year, the Texas Education Agency found that some schools were actually expelling students with disabilities to get below this 8.5% threshold, kids who are already in special ed. So I would say there's two connections. First of all, schools we already know, and the Texas Education Agency has already found that schools are expelling students with disabilities improperly, and that could be motivated by trying to get below this 8.5%. And then on the other end, the reason why we have such a high rate of suspensions may be in part because when we don't provide services to help these kids, that is the result that they have these behavioral problems, among other results.
I've been speaking with Brian Rosenthal. He is the reporter at the Houston Chronicle who broke the story, finding that tens of thousands, possibly more, of Texas students with disabilities have been kept out of special education. I think it's illegal. We'll see what ends up happening. But Brian, congratulations on your incredibly important reporting, and I look forward to reading the rest of the series.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission. Because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Lockdown, solitary, segregation, the hole. There are lots of terms for it, but solitary confinement is in widespread use throughout our nation's prisons. And as a new report finds, tens of thousands of those individuals may be people with mental illness. With me to discuss what this means, whether this is legal, and what advocates are doing to change this is Anna Guy. She's with the Avid Prison Project. Anna, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Hi, good morning, Rebecca. Thanks
so,
for having me.
Anna, kick us off. What did your report find? What's going on when it comes to the use of solitary confinement or segregation, as your report calls it, in the United States?
Well, we set out to write the report knowing that segregation disproportionately affects people with mental illness. And what we saw when we talked to protection and advocacy agencies around the country was that lots of states and lots of people are being affected by segregation. Oftentimes, people wind up in segregation due to symptoms of their mental illness, and experts say that people who didn't previously have a mental illness or experience symptoms can acquire those symptoms due to the harmful conditions in segregation. And so we sort of set out to highlight those issues, since there's a ton of information about segregation circulating in the world right now. We wanted to really put the voices of people with disabilities and the perspectives of the disability community at the forefront of that conversation and highlight some of the work that the protection and advocacy agencies are doing in this area.
Now, before we get too deep into what your report found, and I should say some of your findings when I was paging through it are just absolutely staggering. I mean, really, really horrifying stuff. But I want to back up and sort of make concrete what we're talking about when we're talking about solitary confinement or segregation. The tragic case of Kayleef Browder brought this into the headlines a couple of years ago. As you noted, it's been really everywhere in the public discourse. But what do we mean when we're talking about segregation? What do the conditions look like?
So for the purpose of our report, we're talking about the general terms, conditions of segregation. We're calling them segregation. But like you mentioned, there are a number of different terms that are used across the varying jurisdictions. But generally what we mean is the isolated lockdown, the isolated confinement of an individual for 22 to 24 hours a day, which means they have little to no access to services, programs, including treatment and mental health treatment, and limited access to meaningful human interaction, among other things.
And how small are these cells? What are we talking about when we're talking about isolating a human being in a small cell like this?
Again, they sort of vary from facility to facility and between the jurisdictions, but I think an average that we highlight in the report is about 6 feet by 8 feet, which is a little bit smaller than a standard size parking space.
6 feet by 8 feet. I mean, you couldn't even fit like an SUV in that space.
Right. Yeah, it's a very, very small space. Often people can kind of touch the walls with their wingspan.
So why are people with mental illness being placed in these kinds of conditions before we even get to the fact that we know a lot about, as you noted, the effects, the consequences, many of which are known to exacerbate mental illness or even create it where it didn't exist before? Why are we putting people with mental illness in segregation?
Well, over the last few decades, with deinstitutionalization of mental health facilities and other facilities were closing down, people with mental illness were, forced to be on the street and were getting sort of swept up into the criminal justice system, and oftentimes for sort of minor offenses like vagrancy or trespassing. And the prisons have sort of become our de facto mental health institutions at this point. And so they're not equipped to provide the treatment and the services that people with mental illness often need. So they often need, they often have unique therapeutic needs that aren't available, and staff often aren't trained to deal with the symptoms and sort of the crises that arise within the context of mental illness. And so they're turned to segregation as a way to maintain control and order within this penological system.
So what you're describing is basically that segregation in this kind of a 6-foot by 8-foot cell in many cases for 22 to 24 hours a day, that's being used as a substitute for treating people with mental illness appropriately while they're behind bars. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In some cases, the prisons and prison staff don't have the resources that they need or the training that they need to provide the treatment that people, you know, with mental illness need.
So your report notes, as I mentioned at the top of this conversation, that somewhere between 80,000 and 100,000 individuals are currently in these kinds of small parking space cells in segregation, sometimes for months, for years at a time. Do we have an estimate, and were you able to produce an estimate through your work, of how many of these people have mental illness or are there because of behaviors that might be associated with a mental illness?
I don't have an exact figure on how many people in, so the numbers sort of vary depending on different research reports, but it's estimated that about 50% of people in prison have a mental illness. So what that equates to in segregation, I'm not exactly sure, but since we know that they're overrepresented, people with mental illness are overrepresented in segregation, I suspect that the numbers are high.
So tell me a little bit about what you at the AVID Prison Project and other advocates who are working to try to shine a light on this type of an issue and more broadly, the deplorable conditions that people with mental illness, people with disabilities face behind bars. What are you doing to try to change and improve the situation?
Across the network, we're doing a wide range of things. So we're doing things as sort of low level. In the PNA system, we try to resolve things at the lowest level possible before we resort to litigation. And many states, as you can see in the report and as you hear about in the news, have had to file lawsuits. But we're also doing, and those lawsuits achieve great outcomes for people with disabilities in segregation. But we're also doing work that's not litigation. And so, for example, in Washington State, we've taken a more proactive, collaborative approach with our Department of Corrections to work with them, meet with them around the table, discuss some of our concerns when we go out. We have authority as a protection and advocacy agency to enter any facility where people with disabilities receive services, which means that we can go into the prisons and into these most isolated and restrictive settings and talk to people and see conditions in real time. And so we bring those concerns to the Department of Corrections. And in our state, we've been able to eliminate self-harm infractions. So the department was punishing people for symptoms of mental illness, taking the form of self-harm and suicide attempts. And they've eliminated that. And we actually used the advocacy work of Disability Rights Vermont, who did have to file a lawsuit on very similar facts, to sort of work through our issues here in Washington State.
And when you engage in litigation, which you mentioned is just one of the many tools that you guys are employing to try to change this horrible situation, particularly at the state level, what are the legal theories that you guys are using? Is it actually legal for correctional facilities to be placing and keeping people with mental illnesses in segregation for prolonged periods of time?
Right. So the analysis that we use is Eighth Amendment analysis. And people are bringing lawsuits under Eighth Amendment, 14th Amendment, so constitutional violations. Eighth Amendment is the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. We have one example in the report that brings suit under similar language in their state constitution. And other folks have brought litigation under the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which attempt to prevent against discrimination.
Now, you've mentioned the protection and advocacy system a couple of times, but I realize that some of our listeners might not be familiar with what PNAs are. What are PNAs? How do they work to try to improve situations for people with disabilities?
So the protection and advocacy system was created in the 1970s after some really terrible and deplorable conditions were exposed on the news at Willowbrook School, and it was an institution for people with developmental disabilities. And so at that time, legislation was passed allowing the protection and advocacy agencies to enter facilities like that and advocate to protect and enforce the rights of people with disabilities. And over time, that legislation has expanded so that we can, you know, assist people with all disabilities in all settings, ranging from the community in their own homes to places like prisons and as deep into the prison as places like segregation.
So one of the themes that your report discusses at length really goes right at one of the most common myths or misperceptions when it comes to solitary confinement or segregation. You address head on the sort of widespread conventional wisdom that solitary confinement is used because it's about making prisons safer, both for the correctional employees and the guards there, but also for the people, the inmates who are behind bars. Is that true? Is there evidence to indicate that solitary actually makes prisons safer?
The experts that we talk to don't believe that to be the case. They think that segregation does not, in fact, make prisons safer. And I think that's important to note, too. You mentioned prison officers. I think I want to acknowledge the difficult and sometimes dangerous position that they have, and that they're sort of underrepresented when we think about our civil servants. We talk about police and law enforcement and firefighters, and we don't think about corrections officers. And so when we're talking about safety, we want them to be safe as well, not just the inmates. And what happens when people are in segregation is that their mental health declines. It makes their symptoms worse. And so what people forget is that ultimately people come out of segregation and out of segregation into the general population and then out of prison into the community. And we should be utilizing that time to get them the services they need to manage their medication, manage their symptoms, be safer both in the prison and in the community, which helps everyone, like you mentioned, rather than making them worse, which prompts more fights, more violence, further decompensation, longer stays of segregation, and just sort of perpetuates that cycle.
Now, obviously, we're having a fairly narrow conversation talking about how to ensure that people with mental illness are not being inappropriately housed in the whole in solitary confinement. This is part of a much larger conversation that we need to be having nationally without question about how do we reduce the mass incarceration and needless warehousing of people with disabilities more broadly in jails and prisons. But to the extent that you have dug in very deeply on this one piece of the larger picture, what specific recommendations did the Avid Prison Project make to try to improve the situation with respect to segregation of people with mental illness?
Well, we'd like to see the Department of Justice enforce the statutes and regulations that protect the rights of inmates. They enforce the ADA, and there are avenues for inmates to take to reach out to the DOJ and file complaints. And so we'd like to see broader enforcement of those statutes and have the Bureau of Justice Statistics keep track better of numbers and statistics. So you talked about earlier, how many people of this 80,000 to 100,000 people are in segregation, have mental illness. Those are numbers that we should know so that we can fully address this issue and know the scope of the problem that we're talking about. We also want the PNAs to be able to do more of this work. We here at Disability Rights Washington, our AVID program is, we've had the good fortune of getting a private grant for this. But most of the, or a lot of the PNAs don't have the funding for specific prison advocacy. And I think as the report demonstrates, they can play a really crucial role in this prison reform movement, but they need the resources to be able to get out there and to be talking to people. And so, you know, we'd like to garner more support for the work that our system is doing.
I've been speaking with Anna Guy. She is a lawyer at the Avid Prison Project and the author of a new report called Locked Up and Locked Down, Segregation of Inmates with Mental Illness. You can find it at avidprisonproject.org. That's A-V-I-D, prisonproject.org. And I would encourage our listeners to go check it out because in addition to the report itself, the website also includes a series of videos with former and current inmates who have mental illness and have been inappropriately and traumatically warehoused in solitary confinement. Anna Guy, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.